All right. Well, you've probably heard about the fact that I'm having my latest book, The Physician's Guide to Money and Life. It is available right now. Now, of course, you can buy it from Amazon, but if you want the best deal possible, what you're going to want to do is buy it from me by texting DocBook. That's DocBook. That's one word, DocBook, to 44222. Or, of course, you can go to the website, which is drfreedompodcast.com/DocBook. Now, I'm offering all kinds of bonuses with this. Make sure to check out the website, send the text, and we'll shoot you right over so you can check it out. Welcome back, my friends, to another episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. And today we're doing another monthly fireside chat with a physician to get to know their journey, their joys, and their struggles with finances and outside of finances. Our next guest, he is a fellow podcaster. But more importantly than that, he is a physician. As a matter of fact, he's a hospital-employed radiologist. Prior to that, he served as a physician in the U.S. Air Force. And he's really been on this journey the last few years to understand finances, and he is just amazed at how few of his colleagues do. His podcast is Dr. Money Matters. Please help me welcome Dr. Tarang Patel. Welcome, Tarang.
Hey, thanks for having me, Dave.
Hey, it's always fun. You know, I think it's when you have a podcast and you hear someone else getting to talk to people, you get to feel like you get to know them, and it's always kind of a trip when you actually talk to them live. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's funny because whenever I talk and then I talk to some of my friends who've actually listened to it, they're like, it's just funny to hear your voice in a recorded setting. They're like, you actually have an okay voice. And I was like, I'm always laughing because it's funny to hear myself talk.
Right. I don't know about you, but for me, it always get a little critical. Oh, I should have said that. Oh, I said an or
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
There's just not enough time in the day. So obviously, we're going to talk about the podcast, talk about what you're doing there. And before we get into that, I just want to know more about your background, my friend. So where'd you start out? How'd you get into medicine? Tell us about that journey.
So medicine, it's funny because growing up, as an Indian kid, in America in the 80s, it was pretty much you had a choice of being from your parents. You were either going to be a doctor or you were going to be an engineer. There really wasn't that many other choices. And so, my father's a physician. He's a psychiatrist. We were actually living in Africa when I was very little. And we moved here when I was 6 years old. But he was an ophthalmologist in Africa, and he's also the only physician in a small town. So he was an ophthalmologist, but he was also kind of a general, general physician for the town. And so I was always inspired by him growing up. And then when we moved to America, ophthalmology was a very competitive field to get into for a foreign physician. So he ended up switching into psychiatry. But he redid his residency at the age of 40 when we moved here, which is always a tough thing to do. He was the biggest inspiration in my career choice. But what's funny about that was that when I first went to college, I had no interest in being a physician. I was like, I'm going to go into business. I think being a physician is difficult and it's too much work. And then ultimately, I was the beginning of my sophomore year, and I started realizing that, man, these economics classes aren't as much fun as I thought they would be.
Yeah, economics is so dry. It's like the physics of business.
Exactly.
It's all theory. All theory.
Yeah, and so I kind of switched back. I took some pre-med prerequisites in college even in my first year. And I was like, I like these more. So I think I kind of headed towards the physician path.
Well, I have to imagine that your parents having immigrated over, this seems to be a common theme on this podcast where we talk to a lot of different folks whose parents have come from overseas in particular. Mm-hmm. And you see this the struggle of having a redo residency. How young were you when that was happening?
I was six when we moved over. I had a couple of older sisters, but it was I was old enough to be aware of the work that my dad was doing. And even though, you know, psychiatry tends to be a little bit more benign in terms of the residency lifestyle, it was still, you know, difficult because he was restarting a whole new field. And so he, even if he wasn't at the hospital all the time, there was a ton of reading. And then, you know, us coming over, him supporting a wife and three kids, you know, he would have to moonlight as well. So yeah, there was a lot of work involved for him at that time.
And so what was it like financially growing up? I know, for example, a lot of the Chinese style is, you know, you save. And getting to have no debt is something that was really important. What was that like in your household growing up?
You know, I think we also kind of had a similar mentality. I don't know that the no debt idea was ever like explicitly said, but basically it was, you know, you didn't rely on anyone. So I remember this story was my dad, when we first came over, and he had been practicing in Africa for a little bit. So we did have, you know, a small cushion, but the currency exchange made that very, very minimal. And then, you know, he was starting out as a resident, and I want to say he made like $11,000 or $12,000 a year to support, wow, a family of five. So wow, it was definitely tight. You know, and I don't feel like I missed out on a lot of stuff at that, by the same token, but it was not, you know, the situation where, you know, we had a ton of, extravagances. So, you know, we had one car, and that was mostly for him to get back and forth to work. And, you know, we lived in an apartment, then we ultimately moved to a house. We were in the Midwest, so at least, things were cheaper in terms of housing. But yeah, it was definitely like, you know, you made the best of every dollar.
Man. And so things were tight, and was money talked about, you know, much at all growing up? You know, what was that like?
I honestly, I don't remember talking about it, until my dad was probably in practice for a few years. And I think it was just because, you know, traditionally that's a conversation, I think, both from that generation that you didn't really have that often, and then also, you know, from our cultural background, it's just that you didn't really talk about money because you just didn't want to, you know, create bad habits and things like that. So I don't remember having the conversations, but then I think by the time I had gotten, you know, went to, maybe really the only time I really talked about it was probably around the time I was starting medical school. You know, that's probably around the time when I'm really first being aware of, you know, money, in terms of, you know, when we actually may have had some conversation, because I was more interested in, you know, background, like I had some interest in finance and stuff like that. So before, I don't think I really had shown any interest. So they probably just, we didn't talk about it.
Interesting. So, when you're doing your undergrad, did you pretty much have no debt at that point then? So talk me through your debt journey.
So I was fortunate. I went to a state university, and, you know, so it was pretty low cost, but my parents, basically helped cover, all the expenses in terms of, my tuition and, the base housing, any extracurricular activities that I was, you know, part of there. I worked also, so I kind of covered those things, but I was definitely fortunate to, you know, have parents. And I think a lot of immigrant children probably will find this to be a common theme, is that, you know, they value education so much that the parents' generation struggled, you know, but no matter what their struggles were, they would definitely, you know, as much as they could, help save and contribute to their children's education.
Yes, absolutely. Definitely a really common theme. And so you have some curiosity, you're doing business classes, you hate econ, and get turned on to medicine. So let's pick back up from there. So you end up getting an interest in science, and then you end up, did you take time off between undergrad and med school, or did you go straight?
I did. I took a couple years off. Actually worked at a internet company in Indiana during, oh, wow, the time when it was first starting, you know, the boom time. And so it was interesting because, I initially, wasn't, certain, even though I liked science a lot, I initially didn't, get into medical school the first year. And then I started working, as a side thing, and I took some master's classes and things like that. But yeah, it was interesting because it was right during the heady time of the .com. So I had a brief flash there. I was like, well, maybe this is the way to go.
Right. Interesting. And so tell me about that experience. How did that color kind of your perception of business? And
so it was interesting. I mean, I think not being in the Bay Area at the time, I think, that being the epicenter for all of that stuff, it was still kind of the community that I was with was, very into the internet, but the broader, the people around me who weren't familiar with it really didn't see any utility to it. And I think that not utility, but they just didn't see the broader applications to it. And so I think that probably was more of a kind of stabilizing force. And had I been in, the East Coast or the Bay Area, I might've probably, I might've had a stronger consideration for pursuing that a little bit further. But the reality was that at the time I probably, where I was, it wasn't, the long-term viable option.
Yeah, well, it's especially if you think about, was this the late 90s then
yeah,
that this was happening?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, there were companies popping up all over the place, right? Like you didn't have to have any revenue and you could go get listed on the New York Stock Exchange.
Yeah, absolutely. It was an insane time, definitely.
I think there's an episode of The Simpsons where Homer ended up working for a startup and, it's like the stock certificates were being used for everything from napkins to toilet paper. And it's like, right. Everyone had an internet startup that,
Oh yeah.
I could get going. So you end up getting into medical school and, tell us about what happened from there.
So I went to medical school in Kirksville, Missouri, and it was kind of a remote area, great experience in terms of the academics and studying. I guess being in a remote area, there wasn't as much other entertainment. So it was good for literally sitting there and, med school is demanding no matter where you're at. So this was a good place to sit there and make sure you got the academics done. There wasn't any other distraction. So that was a good thing. One of the interesting things about the med school was, even though it was a rural location, they were one of the earliest med schools in the country to have a mandatory laptop requirement. And they had they had each classroom, each seat basically had an internet adapt, like an Ethernet connection. And so it was one of the funnier experiences was that, again, this goes back to the internet craziness, but at the time, one of my good friends in med school was trading .com stocks during class.
Nice.
And so that was one of the funnier financial memories I had because, you're sitting there watching lecture. And on the side, my buddy was, trading stocks and making, some days $10,000 a day and some days, of course, losing it. But it was just an interesting experience to have. And you're in the middle of nowhere. And yet, these guys are just like, riding the waves of the .com, that the same thing was happening, in New York and San Fran and stuff like that, my buddy here in Missouri was participating in that.
So was that something you were drawn to?
It was definitely very interesting. And I was like, it was very risky. And so that was a little bit, I was a little bit averse to it. I was interested definitely in it. And he got a few of our friends to just do a little bit of it, but he was more of it was just us watching him.
I'm just imagining, you're in class and, look at this. And then, you're like peering over his laptop and
So in between lectures, we were, being med school, so we were always in the same room, unlike, college campuses and stuff. So other than doing our labs, our main lectures were in the same room. So yeah, between classes, there'd be a bump in the market and he'd be like, oh my God, I had this, and God, half those stocks, probably more than half, don't exist anymore. And he's like, I just made 10 grand. we're like, oh my goodness. And then his roommate who didn't really care about it at all was like, all I want is you to buy me a pizza tonight.
Yeah, you can afford it a little bit.
Exactly. He ended up doing very well. He didn't necessarily keep all of the profits, but I don't think very many did. But he ended up actually being able to pay off his med school loans and buy himself a car by the end. So that was worked out pretty good for him.
Oh, that's nice. So what about you? What happened for you with med school? So undergrad was taken care of. Did you have much in the way of med school debt then?
I didn't. Similarly, again, this was my parents. I think part of it's just that, the dream of their child becoming a physician, they sacrificed and saved for that. So I was definitely fortunate to have them cover the vast majority of my med school, most all of it. So I was definitely fortunate in that sense.
Wow, what a blessing. So you got a med school. Did you know you wanted to be in radiology in particular for a specialty? Or tell us about that.
I did. I think, going through the med school, when I first started med school, I wasn't sure. I really didn't have any idea. But when I did my rotations going through, the surgery or the medicine fields, I liked surgery. I thought surgery was great. The lifestyle was brutal. And going through, the rotations where you're there basically at 3:30 in the morning to round on the patients and you don't get home till, 8, 9 PM at best. And then having to do that again the next day, even if you weren't on call, and if you're on call, you had to stay the night. I was like, I just can't see that doing this for 5 years, during a general surgery residency, much less the rest of my life. And I knew that it would get better, but I was just like, it wasn't great. I just didn't enjoy it enough to do that. Mm. And then with the medicine fields, I thought the academic part of medicine was great. I was like, oh, it's great to learn about all these diseases, but it was just tough that you weren't, the routine part of it was just a lot of patients, older patients with similar diseases, most of them came in with complications of atherosclerosis or heart disease or diabetes. And that's what it was, just ended up being a little bit. Even though you learned a lot about the different disease process, I just didn't find the actual day-to-day of it stimulating enough.
Interesting. Huh. So you're in residency now. Let's just keep on moving forward with your story. And you don't have much or at all in the way of student debt. So you're making a little bit of money, maybe 50K or something like that. Tell me financially, it sounded like your parents... obviously money was important to them, but you didn't talk about it a whole lot. You mentioned early on. So walk us through what happened in residency for you financially and fellowship, going into that.
So actually that's around the time that I had signed up with the Air Force. And so they provided a good, stipend as well. And so that helped carry me in terms of, because I did residency in New York City, which was, unbelievably expensive.
Oh, yeah.
And so even I had subsidized housing at Cornell, which is one of the big perks that they have there. But even still, even though our market rate was, I want to say $2,500 a month for my apartment, I was paying $1,200, but still, compared to my friends in the Midwest, I was still paying, a higher amount. So the financial benefit of the Air Force definitely helped out a lot during residency. And then I got married to my wife in the second year, or actually third year of my residency. And so, she was an optometrist, and at the time she was working in New Jersey. So financially, between the two of us, we were doing decent, you know, and not great in New York, but pretty good. But that's around the time that I really started, I think, getting more interested in the financial topics. And so I, you know, at that time, I think, you know, I guess I'd gotten a little bit older. My dad probably was, you know, willing to talk a little bit more about it because I wasn't just some dumb kid at that point. So, you know, we started talking and you know, I would read some things and then, you know, some of my colleagues and I, we would discuss things. And at the time then, that's when I had become a little bit more aware of some of the, I guess some of the issues that physicians deal with, including my own dad at the time. You know, he had probably made some financial errors in his career. And he just didn't, at the time, there wasn't really enough knowledge out there or available, I guess I should say, you know, for him to learn some of these things. But now in talking with him at that point, you know, I was trying to make sure that I didn't repeat some of the mistakes, you know, just trying to learn from him too. And I mean, likewise, I've made mistakes too, but, you know, always trying to continuously improve with that.
Absolutely. Kaizen, right? Continuously improve. So what were some of those mistakes, if you don't mind sharing that, that your dad had made that he was like, don't do this, son. Don't go down that path. What were some of those things?
Well, I think my dad is a, and to his credit, he's a very trusting individual. And so, you know, when he came here to America, we didn't know a ton of people.
Right.
And physicians, you know, are, especially those in residency, you know, they fall prey to whoever kind of comes and sees them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they must have had a talk or something at one of their residency meetings. And, you know, and so he would make some investments with people. And this isn't necessarily stocks or anything like that. It was just, you know, their colleagues would talk and then they would, oh, I know a guy, you know. And so one that stands out in particular to me was they had bought some land back in Florida in the mid 80s or right after he got out of residency. Mm. You know, that probably was, you know, sounded like a good deal. And it was a friend of a friend, you know, mm-hmm. And you know how those end up working out. I think they may still have the land here 30 years later and it's not worth yet what they paid for it.
Right.
So, you know, that was just one. And, you know, and then he did some of the similar things that I think many other people do. And that's a lot of, you know, I mean, honestly, it's some stock trading and high fees and things like that.
All right. Well, let's take a pause here for a second and go to our commercial break. Well, if you are like some members of my audience, you are committed to being an amazing doctor and succeeding at life. But the truth is you've never had all this financial training during medical school, and you're just struggling with enough time to do it all. Well, my friend, over 2 years ago, I started on this journey of writing my next book. And it was a book for residents and fellows, and I reached out to a few potential authors, and Amanda Liu joined me on this journey. Finally, it is available, The Physician's Guide, The Young Physician's Guide to Money and Life. It is packed with pretty much anything and everything you want to know as a young physician. Millionaire mindset, debt payoff, buying your first home, and contract negotiation. Now, of course, you can pick it up at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any major vendor. However, if you want the best deal possible, you are going to want to get it from me by texting DocBook. That's all one word, DocBook, to 44222. Or going to drfreedompodcast.com/DocBook. Now, why am I suggesting to do this? Well, it's because I am offering the sun, the moon, and the stars when you buy it directly from me. Because not only will you get a physical copy of the book, for only about $25, $24.95, you are going to get the following as a bonus. Of course, the physical copy of the book, an electronic copy of the book, an audio copy of my other book, The Freedom Formula for Physicians, all of the episodes of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, over 4 seasons worth of material, And you're going to get an electronic copy of the newest edition of the Tax Reduction Prescriptions. And on top of that, you're going to get a whole new write-up on my journey in land investing. You're going to get exclusive content on that as I am going forward. My friends, this is over $100 retail of priceless knowledge. Are you ready to pick up this book and all the bonuses and get all that financial training that you've desired? You're going to get it from me by texting DocBook. Again, that's all one word, DocBook, to 44222. Or going to www.drfreedompodcast.com/DocBook. To snag your copy now, text DocBook to 44222. Or going to drfreedompodcast.com/DocBook. And now, back to the show. And so I think about these things, like my folks, they got involved in the savings and loan crisis. That was one thing that kind of impacted me, that they went through. And for me, it kind of became some of my lessons along the way was having control and liquidity and visibility was super important to me. What are some of those same lessons perhaps with you, it sounds like, with your dad, with his land business?
Yeah, I think so. I think that was one. And I think one for me was, you know, and they had ended up partnering with some other friends in other deals that, you know, ended up okay, but for a long time kind of had stressed them out. And so one of the things for me was that just, you know, you had to separate friendship from business. And it wasn't that you couldn't be in partners with your friends, but you just had to understand, you know, more formal legal structures, which, you know, I think in that generation, it was much more handshake kind of deals. And so, you know, I think those are some of the things that I was a little bit leery of getting involved with. And so, and that may be, you know, something that I may have swung a little bit too far the other way. Mm. So, you know, again, I'm always trying to, you know, figure those things out. So I definitely, you know, I'm in the middle, I would say, of my investing journey. I mean, not probably earlier still, but I want to improve on the things that, you know, that my father taught me, and then some of the mistakes that I've made myself. And I think that in their generation, you know, physicians didn't have the financial burdens that the generation of physicians that I'm part of and then subsequent physicians now have. Yes. They just have much less margin of error.
Yes.
And so they can't make those mistakes now.
Yeah, it'd take you longer and longer to recover. I mean, I think it really, part of it, I think, is income levels and revenue relative to inflation, right? Yes. I mean, you know, it's not bad. I mean, it's still great money.
Oh, no, still very, I don't want anyone to think that that's not the case. We definitely do well. But if you, like you said, if you adjust for inflation, my father still works, not because he has to, he just enjoys working, but he always tells me that, you know, if you look back what he was making in the late 80s to early 90s, it really has not gone up at all in real, in actual numbers. And then you factor in inflation and it's, you know, it's definitely come down.
Yeah, it's something. It is something. And I think, there's definitely a great future in medicine.
Yes.
How are you thinking about radiology in particular? Because I know that radiology is an area that I know some radiologists are more thinking, okay, interventional radiology is something that I could see myself in. How are you thinking about that, you know, in terms of financially and being a radiologist down the road?
So for radiology, interventional radiology is a great field. I when I first went into radiology, I actually thought that that's what I was going to do. But again, they ended up, when I was doing my rotations in residency through there, it was a much like a surgical lifestyle. You know, those physicians, the interventional radiologists are there pretty much, you know, at any hour, because a lot of times now, before a surgeon will operate on an emergent case, they may want a radiologist to go in and embolize, like if someone comes in with a bleeding, you know, like a laceration of the spleen, or a small artery, they may actually ask radiology to come in and embolize or clot off that vessel so that when they go into surgery, things are more controlled. And so the surgeon can then, you know, potentially wait a little bit because the patient will be stabilized, but the radiologist would have to go in first before that patient is stabilized. So that way, you know, so their lifestyle tends to be a little bit more on demand. Mm-hmm, and honestly, that's not what I wanted for my family life. I love the field. The technical skills that are required are phenomenal. They do some amazing things. And that field, and I think radiology in general is still a very, you know, in demand. They do some, you know, they're constantly developing new techniques to treat things, not just acute things, but like tumors, aneurysms, you know, non-invasively. So I think that interventional radiology has a very bright future. And if I'm not mistaken, it was one of the more competitive residency applications this year. Mm-hmm. And then radiology, it's interesting. There's a lot of right now. So the job market has actually turned quite a bit. So in the last 5 years, radiology had actually gone through a pretty significant downturn. Mm-hmm. Jobs were scarce. But in the last year and a half, I want to say the job market has flipped around. So it's, mm-hmm. it's pretty good, but the longer term outlook is a little bit cloudier because there's a lot of concern about what artificial intelligence is going to,
right.
What role artificial intelligence is going to play. I'm a little bit, I think there's been a lot of promise for artificial intelligence. I still think that what it's going to end up doing is it's going to assist the radiologist and make our lives a little bit better, because some of the more monotonous stuff that we do in terms of, as a diagnostic radiologist, which I am, in terms of, you know, measuring things and comparing a tumor from, you know, one scan or three scans prior, it will help automate some of that. So I actually think our life will get better. I don't think it's going to replace the radiologist in the next 10 years. Now, looking beyond that, I don't know. But I would say that in that sense, looking beyond that, artificial intelligence could shape not just radiology, but a lot of other fields as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's part of the reason for me why I've been doing some of my financial experiments and doing other things, because I'm concerned about this whole wave, and I don't want to be dependent on one income source.
Exactly.
And so that's why getting into the land flipping thing has been a great thing for me. Is that something in your mind, you know, that as you look at that, you know, more than 10 years out, because your career is probably going to last more than another 10 years, I would guess. Are you trying to sock away, you know, a bunch of money or create income streams, you know, knowing that that's a possible thing? Or maybe you're just not concerned about it because you just say, oh, gosh, I think I can have financial independence in 3, 4, 5 years or something like that. Tell me about how you're preparing for all this financially.
So I think that that's the key issue that, you know, I talk about with a lot of people, both on my podcast and just in general, is that, you know, the pace of change has never been faster. And so, you know, we can make all these predictions and, you know, no one ever checks whether these predictions are accurate in the long run, right? No, there's no consequence for making an incorrect prediction.
Dude, this is true.
And so, yeah, but at the same time, I mean, I do. I absolutely want to be independent of my profession financially. I don't want to stop practicing radiology, but I don't want to rely on that as my income source. So, yeah, I mean, my goal is to be financially independent within, you know, before that happens. I don't know the exact time span that it's going to happen, but I want to have saved enough or, you know, reduced my debts enough to not worry about what's going to happen to the practice of radiology. And to be honest, it's not just artificial intelligence that is an issue. I mean, you know, we all know healthcare costs are unsustainable. Mm-hmm. And so, unfortunately, the political pressure is always to reduce the reimbursement to physicians. And, you know, I get that. I mean, but that's not really the bulk cause of these costs. Mm-hmm. I'm always concerned that third parties in healthcare have been, you know, relatively they've been, you know, no one likes insurance companies, to be honest, but they've been held, you know, people want to treat the costs of healthcare as in, well, as long as everyone gets insurance. Well, that's not really the cost is the issue, not the fact whether people have insurance or not.
Right.
If everyone could cover their care without having insurance because the costs were reasonable, we wouldn't have to have insurance. So I think that the underlying issues have to be addressed. And so anyway, my point was that those factors, whether they get addressed or not, ultimately reimbursement is going to come down. So we cannot rely on sustained financial growth from our professions. And so, yeah, I've been trying to figure out, different revenue streams, different investment ideas. And to be honest, I'm not sure, other than saving a ton of money, what the right answer is, because I'm still exploring that part. I haven't, as I talked about earlier, I haven't probably been as active on the other side of investments in terms of real estate or non-equity as I could be. And some of that is just that, you know, like I said, my father's things, but then I also went through the housing crash back in the 2000s when I got out of residency and I moved to Las Vegas to practice for the Air Force. My own residence there was, I lost 60 or 70% of the value.
Right.
So
that
made me a little bit leery also. You know, on the flip side, I was able to fortunately buy a home in Arizona during the downturn. So in the long run, I'll probably even out, but it definitely has colored my perspective on real estate too.
Yeah, I totally hear that. And so with all that in mind, what are you exploring? You know, tell us about your journey of having all this in mind and kind of looking into different things, or, you know, at this point, what's appealing to you? You know, how are you walking that out?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, in terms of investments, I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to learn as much as I can about all different types. Right now, in my mind, I don't know that there's any, there may be a case for an individual stock that may be underpriced, but broadly speaking, I feel like the equities markets are pretty overpriced, especially the U.S. The U.S. real estate market is for the most part, has caught up to where it was in the before the housing crash, and a lot of places, the coastal areas have gone past that.
Yes.
So and then on the flip side, a lot of money, because interest rates were so low, there was a lot of institutional money that had poured into other classes like multifamily housing and hotels and things. So everything has been priced up. And so I don't know. I don't know. I'm not excited about any one particular class right now. And again, I'm still learning. So there may be things that I'm missing. I'm sure there are. But just the general things that most people invest in, I don't know. I'm not finding deals right now. And so to be quite honest, a lot of things, to me, I haven't sold a lot of stuff, but I haven't put any new money in for the last year and a half, other than just my general retirement account.
Sure. Well, and I think that's one theory, right? I mean, you just do what Warren Buffett does a lot of time. You have a war chest of cash to go out and buy stuff when and if asset prices of all sorts fall down in a bad economy. So I think that's one theory, and one that we haven't talked about too much here. You know, a lot of times everyone says, put your money to work, go buy something, right, of an asset of some sort, which isn't necessarily a bad deal at all. But on the other hand, if you've invested all of your cash, when things do go down, now you can't buy stuff that's at a discount unless you get leverage of some sort, assuming it's available.
Exactly. And exactly what you brought up about Warren Buffett. I mean, I've read his, a couple of his autobiographies. I read the Berkshire letters. And currently speaking, Berkshire has, 25% of their market cap is cash right now. 20 to 25%. And I got to think that if one of the, you know, if the best investor of all time is doing that, you know, it won't be the worst thing. Now, on the flip side, you know, no one advocates market timing and things like that. So, you know, a lot of people would tell you just keep buying, and ultimately your dollar cost average, you know, you will be okay. And that's true. I'm not claiming to know one way or the other what's going to happen. I had a similar feeling about housing back in the late, in 2006, before I bought the house in Vegas, but I didn't listen to myself at that time. And I've regretted it since. So, this time I feel like, you know, this is part of my evolution, I guess, as an investor, but I don't know, gut feeling, they're not something that, you know, you can, pass along to everyone else. So,
hey, well, you know, it's, everyone has to make a call for themselves and take their own risk. And, right. That's why for me, doing the land investing has been so interesting, because when you're buying for 25 cents on the dollar, 30 cents on the dollar, yes. You know, if I'm able to sell it for 60 cents on the dollar, that's okay. So
yeah, I take that back about land, because I land here in Arizona recently, there was some announcement, Bill Gates had just bought up some land in, yes. Outside of Phoenix.
Yes.
And it had actually, you know, so we had had some presentations about land investing. And so that is one thing that I had looked into. But then that announcement by Bill Gates spiked it up quite a bit.
Oh,
so
yeah.
that changed it. But I haven't gotten involved in that as much as I would like to.
Well, everything.
But I do think that's not a bad thought to look into.
Everything takes time, too. You know, when you're investing time to learn how to do it yourself, of course, you know, I think there's the time aspect when you have a family and everything is not always the easiest thing to do, depending upon your job.
Right.
Well, tell me more about the podcast, Dr. Money Matters. I know you started out with putting a few episodes out there, and now you're like, consistently putting out what, like two a week or something like that, or two a month? So
yeah, I'm trying to get to about three a month. It's been, you know, it's been going really well the last few months. I want to say I've had some pretty significant growth, which is always nice to see, because when you're first putting something out there, you have no idea, you know, if people are going to listen. And so it's interesting. But now I guess it's been out for about a year. I have like 26, 27 episodes. And in the last few months, I've been more consistent with it. I kind of took a break after the first 15 or so episodes. And I kind of was saying, you know, trying to promote it a little bit to my fellow physicians. And then I put some more out, and I've gotten some good feedback. So, yeah, I mean, the goal of my podcast is really to explore these financial topics that, you know, and the mistakes that I've made, that, you know, the ones that we talk about, like people like my father have made, and to try to help eliminate that as best we can. No one's going to eliminate them perfectly, because that's what investing is. Investing, you expect to make mistakes, but just eliminate some of the financial mishaps and missteps along the way, because some of them can be controlled a little bit better than they have been. And so, you know, that's the goal. But I've also addressed, you know, other topics like physician burnout, mm-hmm. and balancing. My newest one, which is actually going to be coming out tomorrow, is talking about how dual physician couples are able to balance their lifestyle. And some of the challenges that they face. And, you know, my guests were really good about how they have become more intentional, you know, trying to prioritize the way their life is structured. So I think it's really, you know, just kind of an exploration of different topics, mostly financial, but then some of the other issues that physicians deal with.
Any favorite episode or two so far? I know it's like picking your favorite child, but...
Well, you know, actually, one of my favorite episodes, one was talking about burnout, physician burnout, with Dr. Eric Levi from Australia. he had written a blog post talking about the dark side of medicine that I think came out June of last year, and it kind of went viral amongst physicians, not just in Australia but around the world. And it addressed some of the same themes that most American physicians face. And I think that we had kind of felt like, oh, that we only think about it in the U.S. medical community. But it kind of showed that, physicians around the developed world are facing a lot of these same issues. And so that was kind of an eye opener. And it was just fun to talk to a physician, from another country about some of these common issues. And then more recently, I did one, my latest one. It was a kind of a dual episode with two doctors from Texas, Dr. Victor Mangona and Dr. David Anderson, who are themselves very interested in financial topics. And we just kind of addressed some of the common questions, some of the routine questions that we see come up frequently on these various physician financial groups. Talking about tax rates and investing in 529s and whether they should pay back debt or whether they should invest, some of those topics. I think that was fun because it was just fun. It was the first episode that I did with two different physicians that were not in the same room. Mm-hmm. And it was just kind of fun to talk back and forth. It was much more, of a just free form conversation, as opposed to most of my episodes have been more interview based and kind of a little bit more structured. So it was a little bit different, but it was a lot of fun.
That's good. Well, I think starting and doing content is always so hard, whether you do a blog or a podcast, because you're doing it for the passion and not for the money.
Right.
And to keep on doing something 20 episodes in, without a significant amount of revenue, or those kinds of things, I just tip my hat to you because I know how hard it's been for me. Wondering, should I keep doing this or not? And you just keep on plowing through it. So congratulations on.
Thank you. You as well. Keep up the good work. I've listened to many of your episodes, and it's fun hearing from your guests about their struggles. So thanks for having me. I appreciate that. But keep up the good work.
Well, it's all about stealing guests from one another. So, you've had some of my people have been on my podcast, and now I'm going to steal some from yours.
It's all good. I think that's how we help each other grow. So that's fine.
All right, man. Well, let's wrap up for today, Tarang. So any final thoughts you want to leave with the audience?
I think the interesting thing that I've learned during doing this podcast is that one of the great things about the advent of all this kind of blogging, podcasting, is that it's nice that we can develop something that's not part, not just medicine, and so I encourage other doctors to do that. That's the reason I've kind of kept doing this. Like you said, it's not revenue. I haven't generated any revenue from it, but it's just been more of a hobby, and it's actually kind of just you get outside of your traditional mind of your traditional day-to-day work, and it's just been kind of fun. So, and it's allowed me to develop a little bit of a voice amongst other physicians, and so I encourage the other docs out there to, whether they do something related to that or whether they just have hobbies that are like painting or sports or whatever, develop that more, because I think we spend way too much time, especially early on, focused on becoming a doctor, that we tend to lose a little bit of the other parts of ourselves. So that's what I would encourage.
That's beautiful. I love it. And of course, gotta know, where can they find you? Where can they find the podcast?
So the podcast is called Dr. Money Matters, Dr. Money Matters, all spelled out, .com. And then you can follow me on Twitter or on Facebook at Dr. Money Matters.
There you go, everybody. Well, thank you so much again, Tarang, for joining us. And we'll make sure to connect, of course, in the future. And so, my friends, this wraps up the episode for today. And if you want to reach out, I would love to hear your story, whether you're a blogger, podcaster, just a regular physician that doesn't have a platform. We'd love hearing from you and love to interview on the podcast to hear more about your journey and lessons learned. Make sure to contact me, Dave, at drfreedompodcast.com. Or, of course, you can visit the podcast website at drfreedompodcast.com. DennisDenistonPodcast.com. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians Podcast, this is Dave Denniston. And remember, my friends, remember to slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle. All right, my friends. Well, that was the show for today. I hope you loved it. And I just want to give you one more reminder. My newest book, The Young Physician's Guide to Money and Life, is available right now. $25. You get the sun, the moon, the stars, all kinds of bonuses, $100 worth of priceless knowledge. Are you ready to go and pick this book up? If so, you're going to want to get it from me and get all those bonuses by texting DocBook, that's DocBook, to 44222, or going to the website drfreedompodcast.com/DocBook. Again, snag your copy now by texting DocBook, that's all one word, to 44222, or going to drfreedompodcast.com/DocBook.